Hello and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. I'm Keith Pavon. We begin with a story that many China watchers have been paying attention to over the past few months. Former rising political star Bo Xilai has been sentenced to life in prison after he was found guilty of corruption, accepting bribes, and abuse of state power. Once tipped as the future leader of China, all of Mr. Bo's property has been confiscated, along with more than 20 million yuan he is said to have obtained corruptedly. Stephen McDonald reports from Beijing.
A smiling Bo Xilai, who'd been publicly handcuffed for the first time, waited for the verdict. As expected, it was not going to be good for the fallen political star. All were asked to stand. Then came a judgment to be broadcast right across China. Mr. Bo was given a life sentence after being found guilty of receiving bribes, embezzlement, and abuse of power. The court has also declared that all of Mr. Bo's property is to be confiscated, including more than 20 million yuan he's said to have received in corrupt payments. Now China's ruling elite will be hoping they've seen the end of Bo Xilai. As party boss of the huge inland city of Chongqing, Bo Xilai's poverty alleviation programs made him popular with ordinary people. And he also charmed the business community. Yet corruption allegations were swirling around. A British businessman was murdered. Bo Xilai's wife has been jailed for this. And according to Mr. Bo, she was having an affair with the police commissioner who helped cover it all up. There's been no word yet from the Bo Xilai camp regarding an appeal, but Mr. Bo has reportedly written to his family saying that, just like his father, the revolutionary hero, he's not afraid of jail and that one day his name will be cleared.
That was Stephen McDonald reporting from Beijing. The high-profile case against Bo Xilai has raised the prospect of more high-ranking figures in China to be investigated by the Chinese Communist Party for corruption. Liam Cochran put that question to John Garneau, the former China correspondent for Fairfax Media, and what will happen next.
One school of thought that says that because he defended himself so vigorously, that probably lengthened his sentence. So I think that's quite plausible. There are some who are expecting him to have a slightly less severe sentence than the one he got.
Now, how important was it for the Chinese government to punish Bo Xilai and send a strong message that they are actually doing something about tackling corruption?
Well, this is it's a really unusual case. It's a really difficult case because, there's nobody in China who really thinks that Bo Xilai is any more or less corrupt than the next person. So it really wasn't about corruption in the first place, and that's the difficult thing in reporting this case to start with. All the corruption allegations are really about what his family members are up to. There's not really a great deal of evidence that shows that Bo Xilai was about making himself a very rich person. He was about power, and so he channeled money in ways that accumulated political capital, amongst his allies, rather than kind of hoarding it himself. So the case in itself does nothing really to further the cause of corruption, except that he can use that evidence that he's given can be used to taint other, even more serious players, further up the tree. So I think that's the key to this case.
And are there any likely suspects on that list of who might go down next?
Well, the most extraordinary, I think, suggestions to come out of this trial were two bits of dotted line connections between Bo and the security chief who used to be the oil czar of China, a guy called Zhou Yongkang. And so there's clear implication that he was connected to Bo's abuse of power at some stage, and so that just makes it more likely that there's talk that an investigation has already begun into this guy, Zhou Yongkang. If so, that's huge. The other most intriguing thing to come out of this trial, I thought, was one of the allegations of corruption pertained to a piece of property that it turns out Bo Xilai was building for the sake of one of his patrons, the former president Jiang Zemin. So both those two characters, they don't really get much bigger in the Chinese system. So even daring to go up to their doorsteps suggests that they are now pretty serious.
John Garneau, if this case against Bo Xilai wasn't primarily about corruption, can you explain for us just briefly, what was it? What was at the heart of this case?
Well, nobody can agree what this is about, but there are people on the liberal side of, and there is a reformist wing of the party, on the people on that side of the party say that this was, you know, Bo Xilai was the guy that took China back to its Maoist past, didn't care about law. His police chief was, you know, presided over a system of systematic torture. So, you know, supreme lawlessness is how it was framed in civil society and amongst the reformist wing of the party. But none of those allegations made it into court. And so it's a sort of very unsatisfactory compromise where the reformists aren't happy because although their enemy was brought down, he was brought down for the wrong reasons, and the conservatives or the neo-Maoists aren't happy either because, you know, their hero is in jail for these fairly relatively flimsy corruption charges.
And do you think it is likely that Bo Xilai will lodge an appeal against the verdict?
Look, my guess is that he will. Everything he's done so far, in fact, his whole life, has shown that he's a feisty guy, that he's not scared of any fight. I can't see why he would change course and change character and not take this further. But, you know, he's got to make a calculation based on the theatrics above all else. You know, would they actually give him another day in court, or would it all be done behind closed doors and therefore not really serve any purpose? So I'm expecting that he will, but nothing's certain at this stage.
John Garneau, the former China correspondent for Fairfax Media, speaking with Liam Cochrane. Australia's new Minister of Immigration, Scott Morrison, says the shipping news service of people smuggling is over. Despite concerns of transparency, the coalition government is restricting information about asylum seeker boat arrivals. It is now giving weekly updates on arrivals and monthly statistics on the rest of the immigration detention network. The government urges the change will deprive people smugglers the opportunity to exploit that information. But Christmas Island residents say they will now step in and report the boats. Karen Barlow reports from the Australian capital of Canberra.
Less than a week after being sworn in, the new Australian government is making its mark.
There's been a change of government, there's been a change in business, there's been a change in how we do things.
The new Immigration Minister, Scott Morrison, he's told Macquarie Radio that the new military-led Operation Sovereign Borders requires a form of operational silence in its bid to stop asylum seeker boats.
We should be clear that what we're dealing with here is we're not running the sort of water taxi service that the previous government's running, where they basically ran shipping news for the people smugglers. That's not our job.
So the public updates brought in by Labor on boat arrivals and other immigration statistics have ended, and they're to be replaced by weekly briefings by the Minister and the three-star military commander, Lieutenant General Angus Campbell. The old boat arrival notifications were never immediate. Sometimes they were a day or two late, but now information will be provided on a need-to-know basis.
When we deal with these weekly briefings and we advise what has taken place over the last week, we'll be advising what we've done about it. And what we've already done is we've moved to rapidly increase the transfer of people who would fall into this part of the policy where they're being transferred for offshore processing.
The Immigration Minister says half the asylum seekers who've arrived since the election have already been sent offshore to the regional processing centres on Nauru and PNG's Manus Island. Nearly 500 asylum seekers have arrived by boat since September 8th. Including a group of 30 who arrived yesterday at Christmas Island. The new boat was spotted and reported by people living on the island, including councillor and union official Gordon Thompson.
There are so many people on Christmas Island and we can see the boat arriving and we can tell the world, which is what we're doing and why we're doing it. We just think the government should be not trying to keep secrets.
The Minister, Scott Morrison, says residents of Christmas Island are free citizens, but he says people employed by the government should implement government policy. That's a reference to the former Labor Chief Minister of the ACT, John Stanhope, who's now the administrator of Christmas Island. He says he's not keen to abide by a policy not to speak publicly about boat arrivals.
I'm more than happy to answer questions on this, but if there were a government policy, perhaps I'd have to consider my position. But, of course, there are 2,000 Australians live on this island. You know, each of us can't but avoid seeing the boats come in. Of course, I've just noticed, you know, dozens of residents taking photographs of this latest arrival.
Greens leader Christine Milne has accused the Abbott government of trying to hide the boats to give the impression that the boats have gone away.
I welcome the fact that John Stanhope, from Christmas Island and the community there are saying that they will continue to inform the Australian people as to what's happening, and so they should. The big concern here is not just about the appalling behaviour in trying to hide the facts on asylum seekers. It's a clear indication that this government is not interested in transparency, and we're going to see a lot more hiding of the facts. We're going to see a lot more propaganda out of the government.
The Immigration Minister, Scott Morrison, says the government is being transparent and is also providing leadership.
We will have the weekly briefings. This information will get out in terms of how many boats arrived and others. But there'll be other things to talk about, though, also, Ray, because not only do you have to stop them coming, but you've got to make sure they don't come back.
Okay.
And there are many measures we're already putting in place to do just that. And the appointment of Lieutenant General Campbell has already started connecting all of those disparate 15 agencies that work in this area.
Karen Barlow reporting from Canberra, Australia. You're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The Indonesian government has embarked on a massive campaign to vaccinate children against deadly diseases. About 4 million babies are born in the country each year, and they're at risk. As we hear from George Roberts, millions of parents are lining up for the free shots around the country.
It's just a little jab, but it packs a punch.
It's been really helpful. I'm happy. It brings a lot of benefits, especially for the toddlers and children.
In one injection, kids are getting free protection from diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, hepatitis, and influenza. It's no wonder, in a country with a major poverty problem, mothers are queuing up to get a dose of help. Such as the enthusiasm, the launch in West Java was like a celebration. Dignitaries were welcomed like stars, and it seemed the whole community turned out for an all-singing, all-dancing display of gratitude. One of the breakthroughs is the government's committed to ongoing support for the program. But with about half the population living in poverty, Indonesian kids still face big challenges. Nearly 20% are underweight from malnutrition, and nearly 40% suffer from stunted growth. At least these children have five less diseases to worry about.
New research by a leading conservation group says the demand for rhino horn in Vietnam is fueling the rise of poaching in South Africa, the world's main source of illegal rhino horn. The analyst from the Environmental Investigation Agency coincides with WWF survey revealing the status, not healthy, is driving wealthy urban Vietnamese to buy rhino horns. Conservation groups said the consumer base is likely to increase in Vietnam if the message fails to get through. Tom Maddox has the story.
To mark World Rhino Day, the Environmental Investigation Agency found the number of rhinos illegally slaughtered for their horns in South Africa will far exceed the record set last year. And as poaching in South Africa reaches new levels, it's widely believed that Vietnam is its largest market. For several years, some wealthy Vietnamese have used rhino horn for medicinal purposes, spurred on by a rumour that a prominent Vietnamese politician had cured his cancer by consuming rhino horn powder. But new research suggests that the desire to enhance social status is the main driver behind increasing demand.
It sort of splits into two different categories, emotional drivers and functional drivers. The functional ones being, you know, that it does have a purpose, that it addresses some kind of medical issue or other issue. The other one is more about how it makes people feel. Now, it's really difficult to separate those because we know from medical issues that there are things like placebo effects, and that's a very real, you know, impact on recovery and people's healthcare. From the research that we've done, it's all about the emotional side of things, about reinforcing status, about making people feel like they're successful and showing that to their social networks.
Dr. Naomi Doak from wildlife monitoring agency TRAFFIC led a survey of people from Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City, funded by the WWF South Africa. Rhino horn reportedly sells for up to US $1,400 an ounce, about the price of gold, and Dr. Doak says demand is all about rarity and exclusivity. Douglas Hendry is from the Hanoi-based Education for Nature Vietnam. He says while their research explored the perceived medicinal values of rhino horn, including treating hangovers, The organisation, like traffic, also found the desire to show off was the overriding factor for Vietnam's wealthy.
So what you find is you find people using rhino horn much the same way as you might own a two-car garage, but rather than parking your two Mercedes-Benzes in the garage, you park them out on the driveway so your neighbors can see them. And so it's sort of a form of conspicuous consumption, gifting out rhino horn to colleagues or bosses, or winning or earning favor by doing so, or just showing off that you're utilizing rhino horn rather than aspirin to treat a fever.
As Vietnam's economy develops, and with it an expanding middle class, Douglas Hendry says the demand for rhino horn in Vietnam is likely to increase.
A majority of the people being arrested all over the world with rhino horn are Vietnamese. Now, that could mean that other nationalities are more effective at not being caught, or it could suggest that there is a significant rhino horn trade going to Vietnam. And so based on that criteria alone, and based on the research that we've done, you know, amongst consumers and so forth, clearly there's a market, clearly Vietnamese are getting arrested transporting them. And this is enough for us to say, maybe not that Vietnam is number one, but we're not going to say that Vietnam is not number one, and it doesn't really matter anyways in terms of our campaigns here. We need to deal with it.
He says that the problem was recognised too late, and that South Africa, Vietnam and conservation groups are being reactive to an issue that took off 4 years ago. In his words, it's a rhino war being fought on two fronts, Africa and Vietnam. Susie Watts, a consultant to Humane Society International, says it is consumption which needs to be the focus of the global campaign against the killing of rhinos.
Consumption is what drives the poaching. And, you know, it has been said in South Africa, and very recently too, that every time you take out a poacher, in whatever way it is, whether it's by killing him or by putting him in jail, there are 10 more waiting to take his place. You know, this is the tragedy of the wildlife trade globally. It preys on poverty. People who are desperate will do desperate things to get hold of money.
It's a challenge to identify gifted children in India, sifting through the several layers of claims and diverse cultural norms. Many struggle to be noticed. Given that India is still struggling to provide for its children with basic formal education, gifted education trends tend to be viewed as a second priority, competing for resources with basic education. We have this story from Maria Krishnan.
In a nondescript part of Lucknow, the capital of the northern state of Uttar Pradesh, Sushma Verma is playing with her baby sister in a cramped single-room tenement. On the face of it, 13-year-old Sushma is no different from other children her age. She loves riding a bicycle, watching movies, and playing with friends. But this whiz kid, coming from an impoverished background, has set a record. Sushma finished her school age at the age of 7 and graduated university at the age of 13. Now she is enrolled in a master's degree in microbiology. But does she feel inhibited or apprehensive about this achievement, especially from other colleagues?
First time they look up at me, they ask questions, many questions, that how did you do this, how many hours do you study. At the first time I feel a little uncomfortable, but then it becomes normal with sitting in class with my elder classmates.
Even though almost an equal amount of girls and boys attend primary school, girls are discouraged from continuing their education in rural India, opting to work, provide support for their family, or get married. But her father was determined. The daily wage laborer decided that an education was what she needed and pledged a small land holding and took loans for his daughter's education. It was an emotional moment earlier this month when another child prodigy, Tathagata Tulsi, from the northern state of Bihar, caught up with Sushma. He too came from an impoverished background. Both were honored by a charity. Many years back, he set a record by passing the class 10 exam at the age of 9 in 1997. Now, he's an assistant professor at the prestigious Indian Institute of Technology in Mumbai.
I passed my high school at the age of 9 years, and that was the first world record in this category. Of course, later on, Sushma Verma broke that record. But then after that, I went on to clear my BSc exams at the age of 10 years and then MSc exam at the age of 12 years, and those three were also world records. So these were my academic world records. After that, I started my PhD at the age of 15. I completed it at the age of 21. Then I joined IIT as a professor at the age of 22. And that also made me youngest professor of India. So these were academic world records, and so far I'm known only for my records, but I want myself to be known as a scientist. For that, I will have to do something very great in science, which I have not done so far.
Gifted children, say educationists, especially from rural backgrounds, often face indifference and hostility from teachers and counselors. Hardly any government anywhere provides support. Tulsi plays down his achievements.
Child prodigies are nothing but they demonstrate potential ahead of their normal age. In India also, if you will see, in 2010, Government of India started a program called Prodigy, which stands for Promotion of Development of India's Gifted Young. They are trying to identify such kind of gifted children, which we are calling child prodigies, and they are trying to see how can we support them, how can we promote their talent in the best atmosphere that government can provide.
But Bindeshwar Pathak, a philanthropist and educationist, believes the system has failed such extraordinary achievements. He has taken on himself to provide support and has over the years helped many children.
There is a faulty system in India that we do not look after those children who can do better in education. So we should have a system where these type of children must be helped by the government, by the society, so that they should study further. There are many students in this country who have talents, but they are lack of resources to go ahead.
The national and even international attention on Sushma Verma has now highlighted such children. The publicity has made Sushma even more determined.
I want to become a doctor since my childhood, and I think I will definitely complete it when I am eligible. I want to serve my country, and I think doctor is the best medium, and since my childhood I want to be a doctor.
The big question is if the government goes the extra mile to identify gifted children from rural backgrounds and help them. This is a big open question.
And finally on the program, American Samoa has been shocked by the latest outbreak of youth violence. Three students were hospitalized after their bus was stoned on its way from a home team volleyball match. The attack has now led the education department to cancel all school sporting events for the time being. A community meeting was held in Pago Pago to discuss the violence. Bruce Hill speaks next to Monica Miller, a journalist in American Samoa.
Well, it comes and goes, and the latest spate was started last week, and which resulted in the cancellation of all sports. Initially, it was going to be just for volleyball, but now the Department of Education has cancelled all sports. As to the cause, I think it's just a bunch of kids who have nothing better to do than to cause trouble. And it's all because they didn't like their team not winning.
Well, who does, I suppose? But, I mean, I was into sports when I was a kid, but I don't remember throwing stones at a bus. That's taking it a bit far, isn't it?
Yeah. This was really shocking, and which is why the governor had called in all of the community leaders, the village chiefs, the traditional leaders from the districts where these schools are located. And that meeting today, essentially the governor told the people assembled, the chiefs especially, that what has happened indicates that there's a breakdown in the enforcement of villages, and that they should know who the culprits are, and they should really tell them that they are the ones in charge, and this sort of behavior will not be tolerated. Now, essentially what came out of the meeting is there's no resolutions. It was just an opportunity for the governor to tell the Matais, the chiefs, that they should step up and do something with the perpetrators.
By doing something, do we mean taking them around the back of the file and giving them a bit of a thumping?
Well, you know, the villagers do have their own punishments, and usually for a war village, for example, which is one of the villages where the bus was stoned, one of the leading chiefs told me today that the punishment is usually $300 for each offender. And they'll also have to feed the village and present traditional gifts, which really means cases of canned fish and a monetary fine.
So they're really going to make it expensive for the kids who do this, you know, teach them a real lesson. I mean, there may be a bit of a thumping in their immediate future, but possibly it's going to cost them a bit and they'll think twice before doing this kind of thing again. That'll be an example to the other kids as well, I suppose.
Yeah, they really need to send a message to the families also that they have to look out for what their kids are doing. But the other thing, that there was a strong message for the Department of Education not to hold games in the evenings anymore. But the Department of Education says that any extracurricular activities have to be done after school. And really the school calendar is so full that they cannot avoid these games. That's essentially what came out of the meeting today. The Department of Education director has said that hopefully within a week or two they would lift the ban, and they would look at involving the parent teacher associations and the villages more than they have.
This isn't just confined to American Samoa, isn't it? This problem of school sport-based violence. There have been a lot of problems in neighbouring Samoa. In Tonga recently, they've actually decided they're going to look at the possibility of merging Tonga College and Tupo College because the two colleges had such rivalry that it was just regular, almost riots whenever their sports teams played, and even when they weren't playing. Is there something deeper underlying this that actually got nothing to do with school sports and perhaps got everything to do with young people in different coloured uniforms? Just fighting.
Yeah, some of the views that were expressed was that, kids have so much freedom these days that really they don't think that, the grown-ups and the authorities will dish out any harsh penalties, and that this is a free-for-all. And there was a call for the courts, for example, to be more harsh with the punishments. Now, of course, the director of education says you can't really expel a kid because what's going to happen to that kid's future, and there's going to be more problems. As for the cause, well, I think this goes back to when our people were warriors, and I think it all comes back in sports, although you'd think that in this day and age that they would learn how to, handle their defeat in a manner that it doesn't cause injuries or damage to government property like a school bus.
Monica Miller, a journalist on American Samoa, speaking with Bruce Hill. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. You can catch another edition Sunday at 1330 UTC on 11835. And that edition of the program is produced and presented by Andy Sennett. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Powell saying so long, take care. We'll see you in 7 days' time. Goodbye, everyone.